Good day, ladies and gents. Welcome to the Fairway Fit Golf Podcast, where two friends get together to talk about how we are trying to look good, feel good, and play good. Let's go. All right, Greg and I would like to welcome to the show Steve Pierce, everybody. This is Steve Pierce. Quick background on him, assistant superintendent at River Creek over the past 3 years, former golf professional at Chantilly National for about 10 years, former mini tour player, and he is here to talk about his golf, what golf means to him, his golf career, and man, just an overall good guy. If you remember last year, we talked a little bit about Steve as he was on my team in the turkey shootout when we were able to take home the trophy that still isn't a real thing. It's not really a trophy tournament, but we were able to take home the W, and that was when Greg was dressed as his idol, Ricky Fowler.
My team had a really good time, though. Really good time.
Team had a good, but Steve, I want to welcome you to the show. Thank you for having on with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. Looking forward to it. You know, I listen to the podcast when I'm at work quite a bit. I have a lot of time to sit around and have headphones in, so I enjoy it, and I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, Steve's a big friend of the show, big supporter of the show, and actually is a good golf buddy of mine that we've been playing quite a bit of golf over the past about 2 years now, maybe about a year and a half, and you know, trying to get Greg out here a little bit more, but sometimes it's hard to get him away from his home course as well, too. So, you know, let's go ahead and get this conversation started. So tell us a little bit about yourself and tell us, like, what do you do in the golf world?
Well, currently, as you said earlier, I am the assistant superintendent at River Creek. I have been at River Creek now for 6 years, in the position I'm in for 3 years. Prior to that, I was a golf professional for 10 years at Chantilly National. And prior to that, I played professionally for a number of years, college, high school, and then, you know, just, I think I'm 37 years, 38 years into this game at this point. So,
oh, wow.
So, you know, yeah. Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah. Did you grow up?
Yeah. I think I got golf.
Did you grow up in the area?
No. So my parents were military. Okay. No. So my parents are military. My dad moved around about every 4 years, and we got here in the DMV in 1997. So I was about 11, 12 years old when we moved to the area.
So you got to see a lot of courses moving around. You know, sometimes that military lifestyle is rough on kids, but if you're a kid golfing, you got a couple of home courses before you're even like in high school. That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing about that is when you're a military kid, you're not allowed access until you're 10 because of the way that their identification process works. When you're 10, you get a military ID, and that gives you access to golf courses and other facilities. So as a kid, my golf experience up until I was 10 was football field with my dad, and he would take us out and I would hit balls from one end to the other. And, you know, there's nothing more exciting than knowing for a fact that you hit a shot 100 yards.
You were already dialing in wedges.
I was about to say, the dialed in wedges, he knows the difference between 190-yard shots for sure.
Yeah, I think there was definitely a tee on the ground for those 100-yard shots.
So tell us a little bit about when you got into golf. How early were you? And like you said there, when is that first time you made that solid contact that everybody's looking for?
Well, you know, as I said, I played for a long time prior to really getting into golf. Just a casual golfer, did what my dad did. He would go play, practice. I would go practice with him. My first round of golf was when I was 10 on my birthday. First tee shot, I promptly hit two balls in the water and, you know, just kept playing. And it wasn't really until high school when I quit playing other sports. Baseball was huge for me. Football, those had kind of run their course, and golf was always in the background, something I always did. I tried out for the golf team and then got a job at a golf course. And when you have free golf every day and you're done at noon, you're going to play. And I would say the first time I felt solid contact was probably that 100-yard shot when I was probably 5 or 6. I mean, I don't think my dad saw it, but I remember running across the football field telling him, it was like, I hit the ball 100 yards. And tried to show him again and, you know, probably topped it or whatever. But I've always had the love for golf. I think it's the best sport. It's something that you can do forever, honestly. With technology, who knows? You don't even have to walk anymore. You could sit.
No, you don't.
Swivel in
so
a chair,
in,
I guess.
In high school, what did your golf career look like in high school? Were you winning everything? Did it not get really kind of locked in or dialed into later in your high school career? But when did it start? Because I'm still looking for that solid contact.
His head shake when you said, were you winning everything? A name popped into his head. There's definitely one dude that he couldn't beat that he's just like, yeah. That John Smith guy, man, he was just killing me in every tournament.
Yeah. Well, so it's actually kind of funny. When I started in high school playing on the team, I was probably like a 15 handicap. So I wasn't, I guess, statistically very good. And most of my rounds in tournament play, I guess, if you want to call it that, were with our athletic director as my playing partner. So I wasn't very good. We had a couple kids on our team who were, you know, pretty good golfers when they were 17 years old. But really what spurred me on was getting that next job, right? Like at a golf course and having the time to play. And I played a lot for one summer and improved every round. And then kind of figured out like, hey, if you practice in between playing, you're going to play a little bit better. And not to hurt anybody's feelings or gloat, but I went from being a 15 handicap to a scratch golfer in about 11 months. So I think that kind of lived in me at that time. I've always felt like there was some sort of natural thing, predisposition, if you will, towards golf. You know, just makes sense to some people. And I guess golf makes sense to me.
Yeah.
At least it did back then. Anymore, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. And he was, you know, we're talking early 2000s, and who was at the height of golf at that point? It's Tiger Woods, right? Like I had the mock turtleneck and, Nike everything. So, you know, I wore red on Sundays, even when it didn't make a difference, you know.
was golf, like in high school, did you feel, or was there a moment that clicked for you that were like, man, maybe I can do this, not just at the next level? I mean, it's, you know, nowadays kids are playing on tour in their late teens. I mean, they're not even 18 years old and there's guys out competing on PGA, Korn Ferry stuff. I mean,
yeah.
And obviously, I don't think that was going on nearly as much as it is now, or obviously with media and everything. But was there a moment, like an aha moment, that you're like, man, maybe this is something I want to do?
Yeah. So, like you said, I think there wasn't as much access to tournaments and things like that as there is now. But for me, I think it was the first time I broke 80. That was a huge goal for me, was to break 80, to shoot in the 70s.
Yeah.
And it took a while to get to that point, right? It's like you're on 18, you got to get up and down for par, and you make a bogey, shoot 81. And that happens a number of rounds. And that first time I broke 80 was kind of like, I'm moving in the right direction, and maybe I can keep pushing this thing. And it just fueled that desire to keep working at it. So that's probably when I sort of had the mindset of like, okay, let's see what we can do with this.
When was that? Was that in high school?
Yeah, that was, so I was actually out of high school at that point, still 17. I graduated and it was that summer, you know, again, spending every day at the golf course playing. Just one afternoon, it was magic. I came to the 18th hole and I had 5 shots to give and I hit 3 good shots on the green. And I think I made about an 8-footer for par and walked back to the cart and realized like, holy smokes, I just shot 79. It's kind of like the floodgates opened a little bit.
Okay.
Sounds like the last time I shot under 80. Just everything worked for a day. And then the next, I think 2 days later, I went and played and shot a 92.
Everything I had,
I lost.
Yeah.
So were you able, so it sounds like that moment came near the end of high school, right after high school. And I know you attended George Mason University right at the road here, home of the Patriots, same as Greg, for one of Greg's many schools.
Yeah, yeah. I was a Rolling Stone in college, but whatever. We won't talk about that.
Hey, Greg, I'm on my third college, so don't feel bad. I'm currently in school, so don't feel bad.
I was 4 colleges in 10 years and for a bachelor's degree, but you know, all of that paper doesn't say when I started. It just says when I finished.
That's true.
Exactly. Exactly.
Was collegiate golf something that you were able to participate?
Yeah, so college golf is funny because I got to George Mason in my 5th and 6th year. So I walked onto the team, which is a funny story. Showed up first day of tryouts, and it was a 2-day mandatory tryout. And I told the coach that I had to leave the second day for a tournament somewhere. And, you know, what were we going to do if I qualified, whatever? And he said, well, let's see how today goes. And I went out, played with the number 1 and 2 players on the team at the time. And I think I shot 66. And both of those guys came in and said, hey, coach, you know, let's bring the guy on the team. So got a bag,
okay,
all the stuff.
I think he's pretty good.
Signed my life away to the NCAA. my life away to the NCAA. I think they could still use my image and likeness, right?
I think so.
Just for clarification, this was on a par 72 full course. This wasn't this wasn't Sterling Park par 3 course that you shot.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that coach would have been fired if he let you walk on.
Wow.
Yeah. Now this was this is a regular golf course. home course for George Mason is Country Club of Fairfax.
Oh, okay. All right. I figured Twin Lakes is probably just as close as that.
Yeah. So that's where we had, our tryouts at. Yeah. Yeah. So,
and what tournament?
But college golf was a blast.
What was the tournament you had to go off to? Obviously, if you didn't shoot 66, you had a bad day, shot 73, you're leaving the next day for a tournament. So what tournament were you headed to?
So I think at that time, they still had the Virginia Public Links tournament, which is for amateurs who didn't belong to a country club, right? And I used to play in that tournament quite a bit. I think I played in it 4 or 5 years in a row, something like that. Just always on my calendar. And I told coaches, like, hey, I'm leaving tomorrow.
So did you leave or did you have to stay?
No, I left. I left. I went. I got on the team.
You got 66, got a new bag, and you headed off to your next tournament. So
yeah, exactly.
So obviously your golf game's coming into full effect. But what did your golf game look like? What if you had to go back to it right now, and if you could say what was your strength, what was your weakness when you're right in college there, probably what, 20, 21 years old. Tell us a little bit about what your golf game was at that time.
It wasn't overly long. I had enough distance to compete. But I think the thing that stood out was my short game. I missed a lot of greens back then and always found a way to get up and down. And that was probably the thing that always kept me in rounds. I did practice that a lot, knowing I was going to go astray at some point. So that was probably my biggest strength. But I worked on, you know, when you're in college, the nice thing is you sign up for early classes, you're done at 11:30, yeah, and you have the whole afternoon to go practice before practice. So I worked a lot on getting stronger, adding some distance. And in college, I did add some distance. My distance control became a big key for scoring. I started not missing as many greens. But short game was always the thing back then that really kept me in a round. I think that's a key for a lot of good golfers is having a solid short game.
Did you work the ball both ways, or did you just choose one way and play it?
Both. Yeah. I was never really a drawer of the ball in those days. I mostly hit a fade. It's a comfortable shot, even still to this day. It was always something that you could control. Fade was never going to get too far away from you, I felt like. So I predominantly faded it. I worked on a draw. It was kind of a pseudo draw. It wasn't really a draw. If I had to hook something to the left, I could do it, but it was never a shot shape I would play to a flag or a tee shot or anything.
What is a Steve swinging? What type of clubs are we swinging at this time? I mean, are we the TaylorMade Burners, or what are we playing?
No.
Callaway Big Bertha.
Back then, Callaway X Tour irons. They were a very small face cavity back iron. I had a Callaway FD3 Tour driver, Callaway 3-wood, Callaway wedges, and an Odyssey putter. Some reason, at that point, I just gravitated towards Callaway, and I loved it.
Whatever's
in fact,
working.
In my storage here, I still have, I think, most of that set, if not all of it, somewhere. So.
We may need to break that out for a round here coming up soon. See how you can still swing it with those.
Yeah.
So now after college is done, obviously you've had your aha moment. You're thinking that this may be something you do. You've already been playing in tournaments. When did you decide? And when you did decide, what kind of feedback did you get from family and friends that you're saying, hey, you know, I think I'm going to go chase a dream in golf, which not being a country club kid, it sounds like it was something that kind of was odd probably back when you were going through this. So when do you think that, how'd that go over with everybody?
Well, my parents were always really supportive of anything that we wanted to do, right? It was easier to get them to kind of buy in because I was putting in the work and the effort. You know, they obviously back then, and even still to this day, golf's a very expensive sport. So they were my first sponsor. They helped me get my first fitting done, correct shafts. They would help me pay for tournaments, help me get to tournaments, help me travel to tournaments, stay at tournaments, you know, all those things. So they were very supportive. And then as I got a little bit older, you know, I think my dad only missed one tournament that I traveled to. Well, maybe two. He didn't come to Q school with me, but he missed one tournament that I traveled to. So they were always very supportive. And I had a good group of friends that I played a lot of golf with who were very supportive members at clubs that I worked at, who also put some money up to help me do some things. Yeah. And, you know, sort of those things in golf where it takes a village, right? Like I'm not independently wealthy. So, you know, you have to be the guy who shows people that you're working at it, but also are worth the investment, you know, as a person, I think, to get that support. So I've always had a really great group of people who supported me, even to this day. You know, I think if I told my wife I wanted to go try to Monday qualify for a tournament, she would probably tell me yes, because I think she would like it if I got a card and she could quit working.
I'm pretty sure
if
my
you
wife,
do, I know a caddy. I know a guy that can help you caddy.
I'm pretty sure
If I asked Laura to go to a Monday qualifier and pay money, she'd probably look at me like I was clinically insane. But
she'd be asking how much she paid for that ticket.
Exactly.
Watch this point.
Yeah.
So not to backtrack, but in college golf, does like back then, I mean, I'm sure that's probably a regular thing now, but like, did you get anything? Did you get fittings? Did you get clubs back then when you played in college? Or was it just you run the bag that you've owned yourself?
Yeah. So they had discount programs that they could get you stuff, but George Mason at that time, I think, hadn't been totally D1 as a university for very long. You know, this is on the heels of the basketball team going to the Final Four. And then I think when that happens, then every program goes D1. So we got discounts. And the coach at the time, if you needed anything, we would get free golf balls. But we weren't getting like Titleist sponsorships or TaylorMade sponsorships. But we did have a little bit of access. And I think that more speaks to the program size at the time as opposed to college golf as a whole.
Yeah. I mean, you look at like, I don't know, like one thing that pops out to me is just like Arizona State's golf facility now that is just ridiculous. Yeah. And like, you know, some of those like UT Texas's golf facility, like some of those facilities just blow you away. And that's their practice facility along with the, you know, couple of holes that you can play from 72 different tee boxes type stuff.
Right.
So, I mean, back then I'm sure just like any other sport, it's progressed so much, but I was wondering if back then, like you at least got a fitting to see if you were playing the right clubs or playing the right shafts.
I think if we had wanted to do that, I think we had access to those types of things. But I don't know that anyone showed up to play college golf with clubs that weren't already fit to them. I think we were, you know, we're all serious golfers trying to play college golf. I'm not going to show up with a stock set of clubs that I bought at Golf Galaxy last week, right? I'm going to do the stuff I got to do. You know, I didn't buy my driver and played against sports.
You're not gonna walk into day one of tryouts with a pre-owned set that you bought at Dick's Sporting Goods, and then that little and order a bucket of balls at the driving range and dump that into your bag and say, "I'm playing a Pinnacle practice today."
So obviously, go ahead.
I was gonna say, funny thing is, I actually showed up to first day of tryouts and I had 15 clubs in the bag. And one of those clubs was a left-handed pitching wedge that I had borrowed from, I think, one of my dad's sets. So, you know, it's one of those that I think the coach and a couple of the kids were like, "What are you doing with a left-handed golf club in your bag?"
Yeah, that might be another story for a whole other episode.
I was about to say, was the 66 null and void then?
No, I took it out before the rounds. It stayed in the cart. I didn't want to carry it. We had to walk. I didn't want to carry 15 clubs.
So what did, you know, obviously you're saying you went from, you know, a 15 handicap to a scratch golfer in under a year, which is remarkable and kind of frustrating. As hard as we've been grinding and we're still staying at the same numbers we were over a year ago. But What does practice look like? You know, what's a practice look like? Not even for yourself. You said, you know, you went to practice before practice, but in college, but even when you decided to go out on the mini tour circuit, what does a practice look like? Are you do you beat up a municipal golf course? Do you just pound balls on the range? Do you hit into a net? You know, what does it look like in your world?
Well, so back then I was fortunate enough, the course that was pretty close to my parents' house where I was living had a grass driving range. And the thing that I probably spent the most time working on was distance control. And again, short game, dialing in wedges. I would set buckets up in 10 yard increments, starting at 30 all the way out to 120 yards, right? Just working on having the shots, always focused on the scoring clubs, because anyone can hit a driver, anyone can hit an iron, right? If you can't get up and down to save a par, if you can't hit a iron shot to the yardage you want, right? Can't score. So practice back then was a lot of finding it in the dirt. I never had a coach. My dad was always the one standing behind me. You know, he'd seen my swing develop as a, you know, a little guy all the way into, you know, being fully grown up as an adult. So he was the one always standing behind me, but it was just finding it in the dirt, you know, just figuring out what worked for me and then working really hard on trying to implement the things that I was learning, making sure that when I did go play, I was carrying over the practice, you know, whether it was a routine or some sort of grip change or weight shift, you know, whatever it was, implementing that type of stuff. It was really beneficial to me to find it in the dirt and find my own way. Whether it was the right way or not, I don't know. But that was how I approached practice, was just make sure I'm doing what I felt like I needed to do.
So when you're out there on tour, what, you know, let's say, I mean, I don't think all mini tours are just like, you know, the professional tours where it's Thursday through Sunday. They're basically whenever they're available, right? And so, you know, I got a tournament this Friday. What does a Tuesday practice look like for you? Are you playing nine holes? Are you just hitting the range every day? You know, are you working out at all? Was fitness part of the regimen? It sounded like in college it was. Yeah. Did it continue over and everything from there? What does a normal Tuesday look like on that? We're getting ready for that Friday tournament.
Man, a Tuesday would have been, yeah, probably some working out for sure. I wasn't huge into working out. I, you know, wasn't trying to reinvent my wheel or anything. I felt physically in a really comfortable spot with some of the things that I had learned in college to work out. And if I would go to the golf course, if I was at the golf course, I would spend a lot of time on the putting green trying to get used to the green speeds. I'd go to practice bunkers, see what the bunkers, you know, we're going to play like that week. And then I generally would play 18-hole practice rounds. Get an idea of the golf course in its entirety. I would bring a yardage book with me and make notes down. I was never really big on hitting multiple shots, but in the course of, you know, scouting the golf course, kind of find an area where, hey, I know my tendency is to miss on this side. You know, what's here? What's the trouble? So just marking things in a yardage book. And then a lot of just reps on the putting green and chipping around areas. You know, a lot of mini tour things are down south. So that's a grass change from where we are. You move to Bermuda grass, and Bermuda grass is a totally different surface when you're trying to chip, when you're trying to putt. And you got to get used to that grass type. So I would spend a lot of time trying to get used to that grass type, and then, you know, hit balls and just make sure that my swing was feeling good. You don't want to go into a tournament with question marks about what you're doing. You want to just be able to execute and see if you can shoot lower scores than everybody else.
Yeah. Sounds like it's a grind, though. I mean, you're out there for hours a day. That's impressive. Yeah. You know, two things do you remember? You know, do you remember one was your first tournament win, or was your first professional tournament win, if there was one? Right. What do you remember those?
I do, yes. And it was actually pretty lackluster. So I teed off, was playing pretty good, but I got done with the rounds and felt like I had left a bunch of shots on the golf course. And I think I shot 2 under par or something and signed the scorecard, and I'm sitting in scoring, and I was in the front half of the field coming in and sat there eating a sandwich, just watching scores come in, and the last score came in and nobody shot lower than I did. And it was a little underwhelming to find out that I won the tournament. It was exciting for sure, but I wanted the first one to feel more, I don't even know how to say it. Like, I wanted it to feel something more than what it
did instead of, you wanted
to chase down the leader on the back nine and then, like, you know, like sit down and have your sandwich. Do you remember what sandwich it was? Was it a turkey?
It was
cheese?
A turkey was cold it? Cut.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. It was a turkey and cheese. Yeah. It's probably, you know, instead of the fist pump, right I had to wipe the mustard off the beard and go shake the tournament director's hands. You know, that was me winning the first, you know, that golf tournament. It was, wasn't as exciting as the fist pump, but, it was, you know, it's still gratifying to have felt like I had more in the tank and still came out on top. But again, I wanted a fist pump, not a turkey sandwich on my face.
It's kind of like my first major win in fairway fit was very lackluster. I had to make a par putt on 18, but at the same time, it was to like probably break 100 or something like that. I can't remember how bad I played that day, but just, yeah, it was very lackluster. But you know what? I've pulled it together and won 2 more since then. No offense, Brad.
Well, you probably look pretty good doing it.
Oh, I always look good doing it. That's the thing. I always look the part. I can always look the part. Yeah. It's just whether or not I actually play the part.
Yeah.
So on that win, was winning tournaments like, Were you somebody who won a lot of tournaments, or was like, I mean, I know you don't have to always win to have a show a lot of success in golf, right? Obviously, the bigger the check, it's in the pro world, that's a huge part of it. But, you know, was winning something that came quite a bit on the mini tours? And if it was, man, how many were you able to rack up?
Unfortunately, no. Winning was few and far between. And I think that speaks a little bit to maybe where I was skill wise, but also to just how good all of those guys are, right? You know, you show up to a Hooters Tour event back then, and there's 120 guys in the field, and every single one of those guys is exactly the same, with the exception of maybe 2 of those guys. And 2 of those guys are going to play that week, probably win. And then you'll never see him again until 2 weeks later when they're on TV playing, right? That was kind of how it was at that time. You know, mini tour stuff back then, probably still to this day, was like a break-even proposition. You would pay the tournament, you would play as best you could, and, you know, if you finish top 5, you're going to make back what you paid to get into the tournament. And anything less than that, you were taking a loss for the week. So,
but you were walking away with decent 20 grand.
Yeah. So, you know, back then playing those mini tour events and stuff, pay the money, show up, have a good finish, make your money back, and then move on to the next one. And those are top 5s, you know, or top 10 or whatever it was, which were great showings. I didn't know really going into it how I would stack up to some of the other players. Guys who have been coached their entire lives, have a coach, you know, they have an awesome facility to work at and play out of. And, you know, here I was playing at a public course when I had the driving range to myself. I could do more. trying to find tournaments to get into. So it was a challenge. And I don't know that at that time my goal was really to win. It was kind of to prove that I belonged playing at that level of golf. Not, I think you have to have the win happen to prove to yourself, and then you believe a little bit more, and then those chips just keep falling. I think it gets easier to win the more you know when you win, right?
Now, at that type, like, you know, you told me you're breaking even and you're out and about traveling. So, like, are you getting kind of, are you just establishing relationships and area courses on your travel path to, like, practice that? Or are you paying money for that? Or are you, you know, tin cupping it and going out there and playing a guy with a shovel, a rake, and a, and whatnot to, for, like, you know, nine holes, you know, I can beat you with just this shovel. Like, are you getting into, like, the hustle and bustle there? Are you driving the ball 300 yards like Happy Gilmore and at the driving range just to show people up? $20 says I hit it over the highway. Like, how are you supplementing that? Like, did you have, like, obviously you said, like, you had those people that kind of helped you out that were at the clubs that you were working at. But I mean, did you ever get into, like, some hustle cash games?
Yeah, for sure. I think the first couple weeks, yeah, definitely. Absolutely. There's nothing better than other people's money in your pocket. Yeah. There's nothing better. Now I would play games and I would let people set the bet, right? Hey, whatever you want to do, whatever the strokes need to be. And I was always pretty confident that I was going to come out on top. So that was part of it. Another part of it was, you know, saving up. But I always knew someone close to places that I would travel. So, you know, maybe get a place to stay for free or very low rate, new golf pros in some areas, and had places that, you know, would let me travel. My favorite story of traveling was going to Dallas for Q school. There's a longer story in this, but it's 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, and I am south of Dallas and I am just looking for a driving range. I've got to hit balls today, and I pull up to this outdoor driving range and they're closed. The owner comes downstairs. I'm wearing golf pants and a golf shirt. And he says, "You want me to turn the lights back on?" And I was like, "Well, you don't have to do that just for me." He said, "You're the first person today to show up properly dressed. So I'll turn the lights on and you can hit balls until whenever." So, nice. You know, that was a fun one, you know, being way out of town and having a guy say, "Hey man, you're pretty good looking. I'm going to let you hit golf balls."
Interesting.
It's always good when another man says no. Pretty good. That means.
Yeah. Well, he did also mention the fact that he lived above the driving range. So it was awkward, but I needed to hit balls. So
he still wasn't a Winnebago out
there. I was about to say his name.
No.
So obviously, you know, it sounds like, you know, I could relate a lot of the stuff you're saying when I was able to make my minor league run in baseball. There's a lot of similarities, but a lot of differences at the same time, because I was with a team and, you know, your team is you and just a couple others that were close to you. So, but, you know, when would that hard moment come when you felt like you were, you know, your dream of being on tour was kind of winding down and coming to an end? And what led you into that next, you know, step, which it sounds like you went more into the golf management side before you went to the maintenance side. You know, tell us a little bit about that transition period.
Yeah. So obviously I loved playing. I loved competing. And it really got to be a lot. And you want it to be a job, but you didn't want it to feel like it was hard work and a job, right? And toward the end of me giving all that stuff a shot and really playing tournament golf, I started to feel like it was a job. It was, I've got to make myself go do this thing that I used to just always want to do. And part of that was, I think I wasn't getting some results in tournaments. And then a lot of it was just getting older and life things happening. You know, my son was born when I was 28 years old, still kind of in the prime of, I think, being able to give that stuff a shot. So my priorities kind of shifted sort of as I was feeling like golf was becoming work. And in terms of getting into the other side of golf, I've always wanted to be a part of golf in somehow, some way. I always wanted to be in golf somehow, right? I always wanted to be at a golf course, always wanted to have something to do with it. And the next logical step for me, I think, after being a golf pro, was to maybe move to golf course maintenance. Now, I was pretty lucky as I was transitioning out of being a golf pro that there was a availability to move over to the golf course maintenance side, which, funny enough, was the very first job I had in golf. So I had already had previous experience and knew what to accept or knew what to expect. And it was a very easy transition. I mean, I'm at a golf course every single day. I mean, I'm not playing, but I'm at a golf course every single day, right? And there's nothing better, in my opinion, than starting my day at sunrise on a golf course.
What? As you, so you went straight, or you kind of transitioned over from the playing time to more of the maintenance. And was this, where was this? Was this locally? Was this wherever you happened to be in that time of your period?
Yes.
Where was this? Give us kind of a bearing of where you are now.
Okay. So I'm in Virginia. I was a golf pro at Chantilly National for 10 years and was still playing tournaments, was doing Mid-Atlantic section tournaments, playing anything that I could get into, you know, outside of that, you know, US Open qualifiers, all those things. And as it felt like a job, I was actually trying to transition entirely out of golf, trying to get a security clearance, because in this area, a security clearance is a golden ticket. And I spent a couple years trying to go that route. And this opportunity opened up at River Creek, where I currently work, to go work on the maintenance side. And I thought, well, I'll go do this in the meantime until everything goes through. You know, I'm a decent person. My background isn't full of craziness. So I thought, hey, I'm going to get a clearance and, you know, I'll go take some office job and have my weekends off and all these things. But as I was doing the job and getting further and further into it, started to really enjoy the work that we do. Each day is a new challenge. Things pop up all the time that never popped up before. And as a golf pro and playing, you always kind of know what to expect, right? You know, Mrs. Smith isn't happy that her clubs weren't clean, or, you know, Bill's guest didn't have a fresh towel in his cart, that type of thing. And then playing wise, you know, that's a whole other craziness that you're dealing with. But on the golf course maintenance side, each day is a new challenge, right? And I take tremendous amount of pride in being able to have an immediate effect on something. You know, when I'm at work each day, I can see the results of the thing that I'm doing. And it's really fulfilling. And I wasn't expecting that when I transitioned over. I thought, hey, I'll do this job for a little bit. I'll get a security clearance. I'll do that work. And I'll just go belong to a country club somewhere. And that'll be what it is.
So as a former golfer, does the way you maintenance, set up, cut grass ever come into play when you are like, hey, I'm laying out, you know, the front nine today. Are you looking at it as, what would Steve do if he was playing? Or, hey, man, I know this guy's playing today. I'm going to trick this out a little bit more.
Well, groundskeeper's revenge.
Groundskeeper's revenge. Does being a former player come into play in the maintenance world? Like when you're doing
stuff? Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
How do you go about doing that? How do you make it easy for you if you were playing, harder for you, or what is your go-to move?
Well, I will say I've never set the golf course up easy if I knew I was going to play. I actually set it up a little bit harder if I'm going to play.
Got money games going on. You got the advantage.
So, yeah, I mean, I'll set it up as if I was playing, if that makes sense. So I look at it as maybe not tricking out the golf course, but trying to present the golf course that I would want to play at that day, right? I'm going to make sure that the pin location isn't too crazy. Make sure that the bunkers are raked the way that I want them to be raked. That things like that. Now, if there's a tournament where, you know, we had our member guest recently and I get to select like the pin location for the shootout, I've always done that. And that one is one where my thought process is how can I screw these guys over and not have it be like as noticeable, right? So, you know, we double cut, we double roll, I take a blower, we rake the rough, you know, we do all the stuff that Oakmont did at the US Open a couple weeks ago, you know, to make it difficult. That's a fun time to do those sort of things. But on a day-to-day basis, I think where me as a player comes into what I'm doing is just, if I was a golfer on the course today, what would be the things that I would like to see, right? I want to see the stripes. I want to see the pins straight up and down. I know it sounds kind of silly to say that, but I've always appreciated really nice golf courses. I think everybody does, obviously, but I think sometimes people don't understand why they appreciate it. They don't necessarily notice some of those things. And as someone who's played nice golf courses and now on this side, I want the experience for everyone who's going to play to be what I would want to see if I was going out and playing that day.
All the pins are placed on the right side of the green, so you can play your little cut in there.
Right.
You know?
Right. Now I like to tuck them left. Actually, I do like a left pin. I think it's more fun to have your playing competitors watch you hit a fade into a left pin closer than their draw. I think that's a fun. I think that's a fun thing to do.
That's mental warfare there, and that's
it,
all.
It is mental warfare. It is. Yeah.
Do the members and other employees know that you were a stick, and like do they look at you differently that you're out there moving, cutting the grass and setting pins, knowing that you used to beat a lot of golfers on the course?
Yeah. So that is a secret that doesn't stay a secret for very long. I'm certainly not going to be the person to, you know, walk over to somebody and say, "Hey, do you know who I used to be?" But I have found that it always kind of gets leaked out there. I think I made it 2 weeks at River Creek before a member came up to me and said, "Hey man, I heard you're a pretty good golfer." You know, immediately tried to invite me to do something, you know, a match or whatever. And I'm like, dude, it's Tuesday, I'm working. Right. So I think they do, my guys that work with me, I don't think they care at all that I play golf. I think when they see me wear my flower shirts to work, I think they assume I'm going to play golf and not that I'm trying to hide my gut. It's like, guys, it's a pattern, right? I'm trying to, you can't see it at a distance. I look slimmer, but, exactly. So it gets out, and I've got some people who tried to get me in some matches, and I've played a couple matches here and there, but I've also tried to stay away in recent years from getting into the routine of playing golf with members and people at work, because it really never ends. Then you never leave.
You just like to come out and take.
I love working at
all the time.
It never ends in their favor.
Well,
yeah. He just likes to come out and meet Ryan and I.
Well, I didn't take
our money.
Listen, I did not do that the last time we played. Okay, did not do that the last time we played.
Once out of the last 20 times, but yeah.
Yeah.
What is one thing? What is one pet peeve superintendent or assistant superintendent Steve has of the golfer? And what was one golfing pet peeve that you used to have of the maintenance team that they would do, you know, on the other side? Since now that you get to see both sides of it, because I know there's things that you go out there, you know, why is the tee box behind this tree here? Why is this? Why is that? And
yeah.
What is one pet peeve that you got out there?
So my pet peeve as a superintendent that golfers do or don't do, well, it's two. Can it be two things? So the first one is, and you guys will love this. You guys will love this one. It's not following the cart rules. as someone who, as a player, is a habitual cart path offender, you know, as soon as I'm out of shot of the clubhouse, I'm leaving the cart path. As a superintendent on my golf course, I need you to stay on the cart path. Okay. You got to stay on the cart path. The other thing would be not fixing ball marks. I think that's really easy to do. I was scared straight as a 12-year-old by a much older military officer on a golf course. So I always fix my ball mark and one other ball mark. I think, Brad, you can attest to that. I'm always fixing ball marks. And then as a player, I don't know that I ever had anything that a superintendent would do. I think it would be in location if they didn't make sense to me, right? I think that's always the big one is pin location. I mean, I can get over a tee box not aiming you in the right way because, you know, you're not really held to where that tee box is aimed. It might be a little weird, but you can aim, right? But you can't move a pin. Can't move a pin off of a 5% slope, two paces on a knob over a bunker, right? Like, that's there the whole day.
Yeah.
I've definitely seen some people on tee boxes that are aimed the wrong way, just aim directly into the woods and then play their slice back. And it's ridiculous when they actually do it. But very, very, very similar. Yesterday, I got the privilege of going and playing Trump National. They were closed. A buddy of mine, his brother is the superintendent there, or assistant superintendent there. And got to play with him, and I asked basically the same type questions. I was like, what's your pet peeve? You know, what do you not like seeing members or, you know, the workers today that get to play the course? What is your type thing? And that was, we were cart path only. And so fortunately I was kind of over drawing the ball yesterday. So I was close to the cart path most of the time. It limited my walk in for the day, but like, that was another thing was like, he was the same way. He was fixing ball marks all day. He was fixing, you know, posts that maybe a cart had nicked and was a little off center and everything like that. So it was cool to play with him like that and get that atmosphere as well. But you know, that's the same type thing. It's like, you know, one thing that I literally learned yesterday is I've always replaced divots in the fairway. Mm-hmm. And And he told me, he was like, tell you the truth, he was like, the only reason you replace him is for playability for the players behind you. Yep. He goes, once roots are gone, he was like, roots are gone. He was like, we're going to have to like, and I was like, mind blown that I was like, I'm just learning this now at 42 years old that like, all it is for the guys behind me. It's not for like me maintaining the course.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, that's, you'd be shocked at how often you get that question as a golf course. Should I replace it? Should I fill it with sand? It's like, fill it with sand. It has seed in it. It will grow back. If you put a divot back in the ground, it will die in that spot. So, yeah. I mean, not always. If you took a divot that thick, you're basically cutting sod at that point. That one will probably survive, but you know, your normal divot will definitely die. That you want to fill it in with sand. Yeah, we give you the bottles for a reason.
Oh yeah, I learned something new that day. Yeah. I was like,
speaking of sand, is the rake in the bunker or next to the bunker?
Oh man, this is the hot button debate. So in my humble opinion, I think the rake stays in the bunker.
Okay.
Now, that being said, at River Creek, we leave the bunker rakes out of the bunker, which I pushed for inside the bunkers. The reason I say that is if your ball's going into a bunker and it hits a rake inside the bunker, your ball was already going to be in the bunker, right? If the rake is outside of the bunker, I think it can cause more issues where your ball could potentially end up in a bunker or something else. I just think they stay in the bunker. I look at bunker rakes as a part of the bunker.
Of the hazard.
And in, honestly, in my opinion, I think we get rid of bunker rakes and we just go back to 1920 and just deal with the guy in front. You know what I mean? Stymie rules and all. Let's get rid of rakes.
Okay. So last one before we have an interesting part for you or a kind of a rapid fire question for you. What's more satisfying, you know, prepping a course that gets praised by all of your members or going out there and still shooting that incredible well-played round on a Saturday? So what do you, in your life nowadays, what's more satisfying to you?
Man, that's actually a tough one. I mean, I would obviously rather play a great round on Saturday than have a member tell me he liked the way the golf course looked. But I will say that there is something really satisfying about knowing that what I'm doing every day is appreciated by the people who are using it. You know, a round of golf is more for me. That's, you know, that's okay. Great. I've played golf for a long time. If I shoot a great round, great. But having the impact on something that other people are using, I think is probably more impactful to me now than going out Saturday and shooting something with a 6 in front of it or something with an 8 in front of it. You know, it just,
8s are more likely coming out of ours.
And there is nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong with that.
Now, how about this? Same question, but if we transition to shooting a great round on Saturday and taking Brad's money, which one leans towards that one? I would say taking Brad's money.
It just happens so often. It's not really that rare anymore. So,
I would say the answer is probably closer to the round on Saturday taking Brad's money. I think I know that one's gonna keep paying those dividends.
It's gonna hurt. It's gonna hurt a little bit more too.
Right, something, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so rapid fire. We'll go the back nine questions.
There we go.
Short and simple. You don't have to elaborate a huge amount, but you know, you get the gist. So, we'll say question 10. We'll say the back nine here. All right. Favorite golf memory. What's your favorite golf memory?
My favorite golf memory is winning the member guest with my dad.
I like it. I like it.
Out here, Stone Lake? Was it at Stone Lake?
It was at Stone Lake, yes.
Okay. All right. Pretty cool.
Of course, too.
All right. Number, let's see, what did we say? 10. So number 11. I got to do my numbers the right way. Number 11. Favorite golf course or golf trip? If you could play one course in the world, which one would it be?
Ooh. Well, my favorite golf course that I've played is Ballyhack in Roanoke. If I could play one golf course in the world, let's exclude Augusta because I think that's everyone's answer. I would love to play St. Andrews. I think going to the home of golf is nothing like it, right?
There isn't. There isn't. I can vouch for that one.
All right. Hole number 12. What's your go-to snack on the course?
My go-to snack, it shifts between a peanut butter Clif bar and a Snickers.
Solid. Is the Snickers when you're not playing well because you're not you when you're hungry? Shout out Snickers.
I think the Snickers is just after I've eaten the Clif bar at the turn. I just need some chocolate, right?
Solid.
All right. If you were to claim the Masters title and you're the next you are the Masters champion, what would be your Masters champion's dinner the following year?
This is rapid fire.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'd probably have to go like Mexican themed. I love Mexican food. I don't know what it would be. Probably some carne asada. For sure, carne asada. And then I think I would have to find somebody to help me with all the fixings because I would probably just eat mostly the carne asada.
There you go.
And, for dessert, I'd have some sort of like chocolate chip pie or something like that. Something that's really like piping hot, burns the roof of your mouth with some ice cream. Yeah.
that instantaneous where you put it in your mouth and you got to get the little hole in order to keep on eating.
Yeah.
I have a friend that loves eating like that. All right. So next one, if you could take one skill from a pro golfer today, what would it be and who would it be?
I think I would like to take Rory's driving. I think when you hit it that long and that straight, I think you're at a huge advantage over everyone else that you play golf with.
I agree.
I like it. Chase dig the long ball.
They do.
All right. If you could play one round of golf with any historical figure, who would it be?
Any historical figure. This is going to be a strange one, but I would play golf with Neil Armstrong just because I'd want to know what it was like to walk on the moon.
Didn't he hit a golf ball on the moon? Or was that fake?
That wasn't him. I think that was Alan Shepard who hit a golf shot on the moon. Could be wrong. It was Alan Shepard right or maybe. Yeah, Buzz? I think that might have been who that was.
Lightyear?
No, Buzz didn't have a club. Buzz, fun fact, just because I know, Buzz Aldrin, before he stepped on the moon, he peed right at the bottom step, and then he stepped on the moon. So there you go. There's your fun
step
fact.
Right to his pee?
Yeah. I usually do that before I step on 18 green.
He peed right in his suit and then took one giant leap for mankind.
Nice. Because you know what?
Yeah.
we can go anywhere.
Exactly.
All right. So next one, what is your go-to golf movie?
Oh man, I would probably, it'd be a tie between Happy Gilmore and I think The Greatest Game Ever Played.
Oh,
I like
that's
those
a solid
two
one.
A lot.
That's a solid one.
I like those two. Yeah. Plus my son's been watching it a lot. So I've had a lot of exposure recently and, it's a tie between those two.
Are you marking the calendars for, I think it's July 26th or 25th,
oh, yeah.
Something right around is, there. Happy Gilmore 2. Love it.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
All right. Two more here coming down the home stretch.
Yep.
All right. If you could change one rule in golf or add a rule, what would it be?
Relief from fairway divots. That's an easy one for me. Mm. That's an easy one. I don't like that you can impact me when you were not impacted the same way. I just think it's silly. And, you know, you can see the videos of guys getting in some horrendous divots and it just doesn't make sense. You know, we leave the flag stick in now. And for years we didn't. It just seems kind of arbitrary and ridiculous in my opinion.
Are you a flag stick in or flag stick out?
Well, because we can leave the flag stick in now, if it's like a really long putt, I'll leave it in. But really, I like the flag stick out. I still feel awkward when I see the flag stick in. Like, I feel like I'm doing something wrong because I spent 80% of my golf life taking the flag stick out.
I like to leave it in here and there, but you know,
yeah,
it's just a personal preference every once in a while. Wink,
I pass no judgment.
Every once in a while.
All right, Greg's got our last question.
Last one. Right. Last one is actually the most important question that we ask on this show. All right. Like I said, I will reiterate it. Most important question.
All right.
Are you original Cheez-It guy or a white cheddar Cheez-It guy?
I am an original Cheez-It guy.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I knew I liked him. I knew I liked him.
Yeah. Original. Original for sure. I could, if I had a bag in front of me unopened right now and I cracked it,
you would crush it.
Eat the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And no question. See? No question.
Me and Brad shared an entire box of original Cheez-Its in Bassett, Virginia, in a broken down motor garage playing at a cornhole tournament. And then he flips the script and says, white cheddar is better. I don't get it. I don't
know. Yeah. I don't get that either, Brad.
Well, this was during COVID when we weren't allowed to be around anybody. There was about 150 of us in this 200 square foot garage playing cornhole. I also was 100 pounds heavier then. I didn't care what you put in front of me. I was eating it back then. So, but my preference is the white cheddar. So, you know, at least I know my money's going to that wasted food that you're eating now. So, yeah.
Well, here, Brad, it's okay because the original paved the way for the one that you like, right? So, you know, without original, there is, I don't know. Have you ever seen the 86 Masters? That's pretty old and that's sweet.
Let's talk technology. You can hit the same clubs that in 86. I may have a shot to beat you nowadays with the newer technology. So
he's going to break out those Callaways and beat you again. Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to play left-handed next time, Brad.
you carried a left-handed pitching wedge in college, so I don't really know why. So anyway, Steve, we really appreciate you coming on. It's been awesome. If anybody's ever in the Northern Virginia area, try to check out River Creek. It's a phenomenal golf course. It's probably
beautiful course.
My top two in Loudoun County, hands down. And definitely the condition is one reason why, but we definitely appreciate you having on, man. We could have gone on forever. I love listening to the mini tour stuff. I love listening to the golf maintenance stuff, but definitely been a pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, guys. I appreciate it. Like I said earlier, I listen to the show all the time and I think it's great. It's entertaining and awesome. And, you know, obviously I know you, Brad, pretty well. And I know Greg's a snappy dresser. So, looking forward to a lot more coming from you guys. And I really appreciate you having me on today. It was a good time.
Appreciate it. Can't wait to see you back out on the golf course.
Yeah, buddy.